What in God's name do you need to solve it for except to kill someone?
That's an outrageous slur.
Google it, mate.
The only way that you can preserve peace is to prepare for war.
Views on News with Mark Latham.
Another new intro. See, Boris. Boris is gone, Mark. You there, Mark?
Yeah, I'm here. Brent,
sorry.
Good to talk to you.
Likewise.
Thank you.
Mate, I just played a new intro. We got rid of Boris. I said another new intro.
Oh, okay.
Boris is gone.
Another one bites the dust.
Yeah.
Well, we're jinxing them all. Hopefully, we'll have someone left by the end of the year.
Ah, dear. So Boris has left the Mark Latham intro.
Yeah, well, they're not too keen to be part of it. I'm sure we'll be looking for volunteers by the end of this.
Oh, it's Thursday afternoon. We always look forward to talking to Mark Latham, leader of One Nation in New South Wales. Now, you're out and about. Whereabouts are you this afternoon?
I'm in front of the high school at Walgett in western New South Wales, having spent the day yesterday in Moree, and tomorrow we head to Brewarrina and Bourke.
Right.
And also Dubbo on Saturday, coming back into Sydney on Sunday. I'm here with the president of the Upper House, Matthew Mason Cox, and our attitude is, particularly in this winter recess of the Parliament, it's good to get out of Sydney, it's good to get out of the East Coast and visit western parts of New South Wales where there are big issues, mainly about Indigenous housing, education and welfare, and find out what's happening on the ground. You know, if you don't visit and talk to people, you can get a very lopsided view. And if you stay in Sydney long enough, you'll think all the Indigenous issues are just about flags on bridges, Welcome to Country, Bruce Pascoe, the Indigenous voice, when the practicalities out here are very, very different indeed.
So, tell me more about your trip. What have you discovered in your excursion this week, in your trip this week?
Well, two things. At Moree, they've got a housing problem where, quite frankly, in the Indigenous housing areas, they build new housing, people burn it down. They rebuild it and it gets burnt down again. And you can go through some of these areas and it looks like a bit of a war zone, actually, where the vacant blocks and the burnt grass normally mean that the house has been burnt down. There's lots of crime in those areas. And I was talking to the Moree Council about this. So it'd be much better to say that these suburbs that are like a war zone, you'd be better off knocking everything down, acknowledging you've got the water, the sewerage, the reticulated services in, handing it over to private housing development to build a normal housing estate and then renting back accommodation, social housing for the Indigenous scattered across all of Moree. Because the bottom line is, if you put disadvantaged people in the one disadvantaged place, all you're doing is magnifying the extent of the disadvantage. And that's what's basically happened there. It's quite a disaster when you look at the vast amounts of public money that are wasted, and the Indigenous people live in squalor. You know, these are not places where you'd house your worst enemy. And then we come to the school. I've just left the Walgett High School where they've only got 120 students, and on a good day, the attendance rate is 50%. So on a good day, 50%, half the school is not here. And this is an Indigenous-run, what they call connected community school, where all the cultural sensitivity was supposed to engage the Indigenous students, bring them into school, get a good education, get a job. Well, it seems to me that if half the school is not turning up every day, there's not a lot of engagement there. This experiment hasn't encouraged Indigenous students to actually go to school and learn. So that in itself is very disappointing. And I suppose my attitude is a good school is one where the students are expected to fit in to the discipline and the programs of the school to help them get a good education, rather than this philosophy we've got where the school is supposed to fit into the community and become Indigenous. I just don't see how it's working.
So you've just outlined some of the obvious problems. Are there any people talking about solutions to these problems?
Well, I was saying here at this school, they've got 15 staff for 43 students today. That's every student. Every three students have got one teacher. It's almost like you could do private tutoring.
Yes.
For the small number of students who come in. There's a housing solution there at Moree that's obvious, but it would mean some people in middle-class suburbs would have to live next door to Indigenous families. Maybe people don't like that. It's a bit of a shock, I think, to the mentality of some. But there are solutions on the housing front. You need to scatter people out and try and build suburbs that feel and act normal rather than putting the disadvantaged people all in the one disadvantaged spot. On the schooling front, you could do private tutoring. There's that many resources being thrown in to Aboriginal education. But I think the main thing is to run normal schools where the kids are expected to be disciplined, no violence, no bullying, no trouble, and to run schools where kids can get results. The best form of engagement in learning is success, where you learn something interesting and it stimulates your interest in other forms of learning. That's the thing that is needed, more than cultural sensitivity on steroids. So I don't see how these connected community schools are working. Their results are not very strong. And at the end of the day, if we're going to do something for Indigenous people, it's all about a good education, good qualifications, and getting a job. And the other thing, really, you know, we were talking about jobs in Walgett, and the Indigenous leader was saying there aren't any. I think government should be offering subsidies for Indigenous people to move where the jobs are, where the good schools are and the good jobs are available, rather than clinging to the historic land rights agenda that you need to be on a certain parcel of land on country to feel good about yourself. Well, there's nothing good about welfare dependency and drug and alcohol dependency. People have got to get to where the opportunities are in life. And some of these smaller towns, if they don't offer opportunities for young people, we've got to try and help the young people get to where the jobs are.
So these homes that are being burnt down, the homes are being built for the Aboriginal, for the Indigenous community, right? The homes are being built for the Indigenous community. And when they're given these homes, the Indigenous community, or parts of the Indigenous community, are burning these homes to the ground. Is that correct?
Yeah, there's family rivalries and jealousies and revenge, and part of that is to burn down someone's house.
Right.
The other problem is the estate we saw, and again, they had a lot of wrecked cars and burned houses run by the local land council. Nobody pays any rent because the tenants say, oh, we're entitled to this. It's part of our land rights. You're a land council. You shouldn't be charging us rent. So the land council gets no income stream and can't do any maintenance. So the housing just falls apart over time. You know, you've got to normalise all these systems, Brent. I know people can say, oh, you know, the Indigenous were here for 60,000 years and they've got their own way of life and so forth. Well, to a large extent, that's true, but they've also got to acknowledge that the things that work best in society are normal housing, normal schools, normal jobs, and a normal family life.
Mm.
So unless we can normalise arrangements and people make the effort to fit into that, the alternative is squalor, welfare dependency, and a pretty horrible bloody way of life.
It seems as though we just keep throwing money at the problem and we're not fixing it.
Well, a lot of money wasted. I mean, huge amounts of money. But the thing that probably disturbs me most recently in the whole evolution of the Indigenous debate is how things like welcome to country, flags on bridges, the Indigenous voice is all so far removed from these practical problems on the ground.
Yeah.
You know, the woke agenda has overwhelmed the political talk about Indigenous affairs. And when you see these burnt down houses, you see these squalid suburbs, you see these failed schools, you realise that none of that city talk is relevant or helpful one iota. So, you know, I'd love to see Albanese, Perrottet, every significant leader get to places like Moree and Walgett and Bourke and Cobar and get in touch with these real life problems and come up with practical solutions. Back in the day, John Howard used to talk about practical reconciliation. I'm not too sure he did a lot of it, but I think that practical aspect of problem solving is absolutely essential, because otherwise you just do the virtue signalling and you wash billions of dollars down the drain.
You spoke of woke. Let's talk about new mum. I think her name is Sal Grover. She hit out at a government form which calls mothers birthing parents. She was on telly this morning, Mark.
I think it's appalling, and I think it's offensive, and it's to please fringe activists and lobbyists who have made such a big deal about these sort of language and then come after us and call us bigots for not accepting it, where it's like, you changed the form in the first place. You have such a problem with the word mother. That's something you have to deal with.
Now, the consent form was introduced in March in some hospitals as part of a trial to upload new baby details to official Medicare records. And, you know, you can't be a mum, you've got to be a birthing parent.
Well, this is a trial, apparently, that started under the Morrison government. It just shows you where the Liberal and National parties got to in their own warped thinking. The truth is, Brent, being a mother is one of the great roles, one of the great honoured, proud roles in our society. And why anyone wants to eliminate the word mother from our vocabulary and our official documents is just so idiotic, it beggars belief. So I'm very glad to hear that Bill Shorten, as the Minister for these service providers, has called off the experiment and said just use the word mother instead of birthing parent, which is like, for, you know, sort of a foreign language. So well done, Bill Shorten. It's good to see a Labor Minister with a bit of common sense. And quite frankly, this should never have happened in the first place.
You took the words
How did the Morrison government end up with this rubbish?
Absolutely.
No wonder they got voted out.
That is the big concern, that it actually, there are people working in the department that think this way, and it was able to be started as a trial. I mean, goodness me.
Well, the disrespect to mothers in our society is manifest. Yeah. I mean, being a mother, and you see mothers with newborns, they're so proud, gushing with happiness and all the wonderful emotions, and then to have to fill out the form as a birthing parent is an insult to them. So good on Sal Grove for raising this, and good on Bill Shorten for getting rid of it.
Mark Connell, a name probably no one had ever heard of until yesterday. Mark Connell was the former Deputy Premier's Chief of Staff from April 2017 to December 2019. And yesterday he made the claim that John Barilaro declared he was off to New York after saying in a 2019 a plum posting representing New South Wales overseas would be the job when I get the, you know, so-and-so out of this place. He has said a couple of other things, and now it looks as though, unless things have changed since I came on air, the Labor government in New South Wales are trying to stop John Barilaro from actually giving evidence at this hearing, at this inquiry.
Yeah, well, I suppose as a private citizen, he can be subpoenaed now to attend, and there's a legal argument about that, but his former Chief of Staff, Mark Connell, has dobbed him in big time. Maybe it's the sort of thing Barilaro said on a regular basis, I want to get out of this politics and I'm lining up something for the future. So it's a really bad look, and I think it opens up a new line of inquiry for the investigation, the parliamentary committee, and that is, how did this trade office get moved from California, where it was for New South Wales, to New York? Now, most of the New South Wales trade with the United States is off the West Coast, and I think California in its own right is the sixth biggest economy in the world. So who moved the posting from California, from LA, to New York? So the more they investigate this appointment, the worse it looks, the more complex it becomes, and now there's the question of who at public expense even put it in New York in the first place.
I tell you, Dominic Perrottet has had some real problems in his 9 months as Premier, hasn't he?
Yeah, he's had a whole series of scandals, problems, the COVID issues to deal with, and I think his main issue as a new Premier is he's been holding the fort. He's like a boy with his finger in the dike holding the waters back, but he's not setting out a vision and an argument for why you would give this government 16 years in office as opposed to the 12 they've already had when the election comes around in March next year. So Perrottet, in holding the fort, that's not going to help him with re-election, and you'd have to say we're looking at the signs of a dying government and, you know, a change in office in New South Wales to Chris Minns.
The ICAC found that John Sidoti had improperly used his position as MP to try to influence Canada Bay councillors to benefit his family's property interests in Five Dock. The former New South Wales Liberal minister has vowed to clear his name in court, and this morning on radio defied the Premier's calls to resign after the state's anti-corruption watchdog found the watchdog declared he had engaged in serious corrupt conduct. He said he's not going to resign. Look, you've got the Labor Party today saying that they don't want him there either. It seems as though no one wants him there at the moment in Parliament.
Well, I've got to say that while this is a new headache for Dom Perrottet, I've got some reservations about the nature of the finding. I spoke to a Canada Bay councillor I know yesterday who said that he didn't feel intimidated by Sidoti. He didn't feel that Sidoti was doing anything other than arguing something in the community interest. People knew Sidoti had family business interests in the area. And Sidoti wasn't the direct decision-maker. The decision-maker was the council. And Sidoti was a state MP. And I think one of the things we've got to think about is that in a 35-year history, once ICAC starts a public investigation into someone, they never report rent by saying, oh, we've investigated this and there's not much to see. We've sort of been on a wild goose chase. They always come out with adverse findings against people, and I just don't see how what Sidoti did was a high level of corruption. He played a role there, as you're entitled to do as a citizen, that if you've got some property interests, you're allowed to lobby a different level of government to tell them what you think should happen. So I just think ICAC sometimes gets out of control, and in this case they've done a 3.5-year inquiry into Sidoti, and they would have looked like fools if they said we haven't found much.
True.
So, you know, after 3.5 years, this guy's had his political... He's not from my side of politics, and I barely know him, but it seems to me he's been pretty harshly treated, and he'll take it to the Supreme Court, and like Nick Greiner before him, he might get his name cleared.
Boy, oh boy, that's going to be an expensive, drawn-out process.
Yeah, I suppose so, but what do you do? I mean, this is a tribunal, ICAC, that pursues people. I said to them at budget estimates, look, if you're halfway through an inquiry and you don't find anything, why don't you ever pull out? Is there an institutional pride where you feel the need to go right through to the end and then automatically make adverse findings against someone? I say, yeah, we've 35 years, we've never pulled out of an inquiry midstream. They feel legally obliged to go right through to the end. I think we've got to change that. That they start an inquiry and there's not enough evidence there, well, there's no shame in pulling out and saying, look, we just don't think this can be continued. And I think that would have been the right thing with Sidoti. This is nowhere near in the league of an Eddie OB to Joe Tripodi. We're talking about something that's a local government matter where Sidoti had no real power.
All right. I'll let you get back to your Western tour, and we'll talk more about the next couple of days next Thursday when you join us after the 1:30 news update.
Yeah, well, it's good to be out of Sydney, I can say that. I'm learning heaps and happy to report again next Thursday. Thanks, Brent.
Thank you, Mark. Stay safe. Cheers. That is Mark Latham, leader of One Nation in New South Wales. If it's